welcome back to another exciting episode of the Captain America Minute, where we examine the 2011 Joe Johnston-directed feature, Captain America, the First Avenger, at the rate of 1 minute of screen time per episode. I'm one of your hosts just a few miles from Kitty Hawk, North Carolina. This is Jim O'Kane of TVDads.com.
I'm Hal Bryan, an airplane nerd from the home of the Experimental Aircraft Association here in Oshkosh, Wisconsin.
And I'm Brian Fees, a graphic novelist and lifelong Avengers comic book reader.
And we're going to wave bye-bye to Red Skull. He'd wave back, but his hand is turning into a rainbow. Hal, what's going on here?
Well, I don't know how to follow that. I mean, you know, my usual, we've all been there, am I right? It just doesn't ring true. But anyway, minute 106. In the Valkyrie's cockpit, the Red Skull clutches the Tesseract, his body dissolving into a lurid stream of blue and red light. He screams as the energy blasts him upward through the cockpit ceiling, vanishing into the cosmos toward an unknown fate. A shockwave of blue energy ripples outward from the aircraft, then fades. The Tesseract clatters to the metal grating, glowing fiercely. It melts through several layers of the Valkyrie's hull, plummeting toward the ocean below. Steve watches it disappear, then retrieves his vibranium shield and strides to the pilot's chair. He removes his helmet, his eyes locking on the control panel. The display still lists New York City as the seal, the distance shrinking rapidly. At the captured Hydra base, Colonel Phillips and Peggy Carter stand in a control room, Jim Morita monitoring radio traffic. Steve's voice crackles over the radio. "Come in, this is Captain Rogers. Do you read me?" Jim responds, "Captain Rogers, what is your..." But Peggy cuts in, her voice urgent. "Steve, is that you? Are you all right?" "Peggy, Schmidt's dead," Steve says. "What about the plane?" Peggy asks, her tone tense. Steve takes a deep breath, glancing at the controls. "That's a little bit tougher to explain." "Give your coordinates. I'll find you a safe landing site," Peggy insists. Steve looks at a display showing several bombs still on board. There's not going to be a safe landing. So another one of these minutes with a great ending, a great cut right there.
Yeah, I haven't felt this bad since Gold Leader.
Yeah, exactly.
Just lost the starboard engine. Oh, man.
Right. It's or like the scene in Hot Shots, right? "Yeah, I lost my wing. You're doing fine. I lost my other wing. Just bring it on in. You know, you're doing great." And then this smoldering hulk of a half a fuselage plumps onto the deck. That's it. It's interesting too. Yeah, we see there's still bombs on board, and then there's you know, that indication looks to me like there's, you know, multiple engines out too. So there's a lot.
I was reading that as two engines out and six active, but I'm not sure about that.
See, I was going back and forth with the red, and it's like looking at, like, on the pictograph of the aircraft itself, where you see the red on the engines, that looks to me like, well, that's heat and they're working, but, you know, red traditionally means bad things, like this is not working. So we either have two engines working and six out, or the other way around, but there's some engine problems.
Does Zeal actually mean target? I don't know the word, but I'm assuming that's what it means.
I was going to look that up, and I can do that slowly.
It might have been the German word for you're spelling New York City wrong in German.
Right.
While Hal's looking that up, I had one note on this minute. Two notes, actually. One is that it's one of the most Jack Kirby-ish minutes in the movie. Jack Kirby, the pioneering cartoon comic book artist who co-created Captain America, just did these cosmic vistas full of nebula and rippling ribbons of energy and crackling fields. And this is about as close as the MCU gets, just a pure Jack Kirby panel. And my other thought and note was, when the Red Skull's energy is shooting out into space, I'm wondering if he's getting a glimpse of Yggdrasil, the tree of life in Norse mythology. It'd be real subtle, and I don't know. It's dark nebula, roughly in a tree and branch shape. I might just be reading things into it, but since that's how the movie started, of him finding the Tesseract hidden behind the symbol of Yggdrasil in the church, I'm just wondering if that's a little Easter egg cap to the Red Skull story. I don't know.
Well, as soon as you say that, and I go back through it, I mean, now all I see in that shape is a tree. That's
just wondering.
That's really interesting.
I, 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 I have a hard time thinking it's not deliberate, but it's right. subtle for sure.
Well, it's also one of the few things in this film that maybe it's the only thing. I mean, we talk about the mythology and things at the beginning, but you know, this is the first time we're seeing something. Correct me if I'm wrong, but so the first time we're seeing that the more cosmic sort of supernatural elements of these things, like everything else is sort of rooted in practicality, and there's mystery around the Tesseract, but now we're, you know, we're seeing into the cosmos, and these things are happening. Am I missing some big other spot in the film where we see something that has more that magical side to it?
Well, we're just coming off of Thor,
right? Right. Yeah. So that is a piece of this another piece that sort of connects it to Thor and to that kind of film. But I think prior to this point, this has been such a solid, straightforward,
grounded. You know, it's been very grounded.
Very grounded. Thank you. There's the word I've been dancing around for 5 minutes over here. So thank you.
So, yeah, it'll seem to have a scientific explanation, but this starts reaching into the supernatural.
Right.
I do want to point out there is a popular effect that is that's in here that was made popular by Star Trek VI, and it's known as the Kronos effect, which also showed up in the special edition of Star Wars. It's and the way once you see it, and you can scroll through very slowly if you get to a minute 106 and just start looking around 12 seconds in, the way this is done, and I hate to show the thing behind the curtain, but it's very simple, but it looks very, very complex. What you do is you make a flat image of an expanding circle, and typically it's done by either dropping a drop of water with a oil that's covered with baby powder, and if you drop something in the center of it, and the baby powder will expand along the top of the oil. And what you do is, after you film it head on, you put it into a visual effects editor such as Adobe After Effects, or you know, there's a bunch of different kinds. But what you can do is you flip the thing 90 degrees along the y-axis so that it's no longer facing you but tilted away from you. And then you rerun it, and it just looks like it's a two-dimensional picture, but it looks three-dimensional as an expanding sphere almost that widens out. And this is the end of the Tesseract power rolling through the cloud deck that the flying wing is the center of. Mm-hmm. And it's a brilliantly simple effect, but you know, thanks to the ability of having computers that can do 3D modeling, it comes out as a very complex and really delicious look on screen.
Go ahead. I was going to say, correct me if I'm wrong, Jim, but is this the same thing that we see in the Star Wars remasters where the Death Star blows up, that ring of energy that comes off the
equator? Exactly. That's where that special edition Star Wars, you'll see that ring of energy. And it's kind of like the Wilhelm scream. You just kind of see it everywhere now. Everybody, when something blows up, you have to have a ring of energy shooting out from all sides. But it was first designed in Star Trek VI when the Klingon homeworld blows up, or the moon of the Klingon homeworld blows up.
And that's really fascinating, because I could have made some guesses about the era, like when we first started seeing that in that, you know, what, early mid 90s time frame. But I didn't know that Star Trek VI was the first place we saw it. But it was just, as you said, it was just one of those things. And then we had to go back and redo the Death Star, because now when things blow up, a big circle comes out. And it always fascinates me when you have something like that, you know, that somebody introduces it, and now, you know, everything's sort of got to be like that. I was trying to think of other examples. One of them that comes to mind is I would guess that something like Aliens might have been the first time we saw what we now call just a drop ship, like anything in sort of sci-fi.
Yeah.
You know, we see the Republic Commandos using them in the Star Wars prequels. We see them in almost everything. There's, you know, they're all different, but there's a, you know, there's a boxy thing that's got cargo or troops in it, and it's got, you know, rotating jet engines, usually four of them, you know, two on each side. and they all kind of move the same way and maneuver the same way. And you know, somebody designed that first, and it makes a certain amount of sense, you know, having tiltable engines, and that's a thing we do in real life. But from then on, that's what that has to be. And then the only other one that comes to mind would be an audio effect. And that is probably goes back to Jurassic Park, but whenever we're up close to a big scary monster and it's tense and it's right in there, there's a clicking that happens.
Yep.
It's like you're getting really close to.
Yes.
You know, it's this kind of thing as this thing is
ASMR moving. Kind of a.
Yeah. And it's, yeah. You know, it's close to you. It's scary. You know, you would have seen that, I guess, in Predator as well. But then after a while, that suddenly becomes, you know, we don't have monsters that are big and screaming. They're scary when they're close to you and making this small little quiet noise that we now associate with something that is terrifying. But this is maybe the calm before the storm.
Your note, it's a great thought, Hal, and I think there someone could get a PhD tracking, you know, the lineage of all these things. First one that occurred to me when you started talking was bullet time from The Matrix.
Yeah.
Oh, sure.
That's for sure.
And to some extent, it was self-limiting in that The Matrix did it first and so well and so notably that you'd be kind of a fool to copy it. But a lot of people have done that similar kind of freezing time effect that was done so well and actually so simply in The Matrix. It was, it's the kind of thing that could have been done in the 1930s if anybody had thought of it, but nobody did until The Matrix. And it's just, it's a beautiful effect. And I've seen it here and there from time to time.
Yeah. But yeah, I think that's another interesting example. This is not a good example, but maybe this is an example of somebody who thought they were starting a trend like this and it didn't really take, but confession time, we've been watching here and there as a palate cleanser, watching our way through the Bionic Woman series, the original from the 70s.
Yeah.
And, you know, little bits of some Steve Austin thrown in there as well. And of course, I would love to have been in the room when they said, well, how do we show these people running 60 miles an hour? We'll do it in slow motion.
Well, what?
that doesn't make a damn bit of sense at all. But we all bought it, like completely. Yeah. And then when they do anything bionic, it'll make that classic noise. Yeah. And I'm wondering, is that supposed to be, are we supposed to think that's in the scene? Like, could a bad guy overhear this and say there's a bionic person in the next room? Or is it truly just for us? And then the huge one that is starting to drive me a little bit crazy, and yet I sort of celebrate it, is anytime we jump or throw anything, there's the big penny whistle. Every single time without fail. And you know, and you think about, you know, so we're producing the $6 million man, and some sound editor says, well, I'm gonna try this. Well, now you're stuck. You know, you have to do that now every single time. And even if somebody decides, you know, that doesn't make sense under these circumstances, nope, too bad. And, you know, that's what they've taught us, that's what those sounds mean. And from then on, we've got to do it. And again, an apples and oranges example, because we don't see that I can think of, you know, bleeding over into other things, except maybe as parody.
Oh, yeah, but no, you think of like the DCU Flash movies. More often than not, we see the Flash moving in slow motion.
Oh, that's a good point.
And he's up over the speed of sound, and he's just
with that Matrix bullet time effect mingled into it too. I mean, you get lightning bolts and stuff, but it's still how one thing I do know about the, I don't want to spoil things for you, for the bionic sound that you get with the
Wondered about this. Please lay it on me.
Okay, well, what it is, there was a sound designer. He's kind of like Ben Burtt of the time of his name is Charles King, and what it was is he took a flexible metal yardstick, a big metal yardstick, and he did it real simple. He put it on the edge of a
table
and he hit the free end, and so he released it, so it twanged. And then the trick was he slowed down the tape to 25% of the original speed. Sometimes that's, he might add a flanger, like, you know, like what you use for the theme to Shaft. He'd add
a little bit of a metallic wow to it.
So
That is so cool. That is so good to know. And that's one of those things I've wondered about forever. And it's like one of the things that for some reason I've just never dug into it. I've never looked it up.
Yeah.
And now I don't have to.
No, but it feels good to know. Just to
it really, really does. It's like when I discovered and Jim, you're more musically inclined than I am. Although I have more ukuleles than you.
True. Who could compare?
I mean, well, I don't know. But like learning the Godzilla roar. You listen to it and those notes are separate. I don't know if it's a fifth or a sixth or something, but at least a good part of it was, I don't know if it was a cello or a viola, and you will probably know better than I do.
Yeah, I had heard that it was a stringed instrument. I do not know which one it was.
But it's just that, you know, those two notes from one to the other, and it gives me goosebumps to this day. And like whatever incarnation of Godzilla, I wait so excitedly to hear that for the first time. And then I get this little chill and I just absolutely love it. And it didn't ruin anything for me to start understand how they did it. But you think about that back in 1954?
54, I think. Yeah, that's right.
54 was King of the Monsters.
Somewhere there's a, you know, sheet music for Godzilla sound.
Right, exactly.
And it's just like dragging one high note and then the low other. Note and it's just some wiggly just line in between.
Those two notes that are separated like that. And I think it was probably decelerated to get it more.
Yeah.
You know, get more texture and more raw.
Yeah, five, six, seven, eight.
Yeah, exactly.
my favorite example in all of film, and I know you guys know this, but some more listeners might not. You mentioned Ben Burtt and the sound of the blasters in Star Wars.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
That was Ben Burtt walking around the countryside, tapping the tension wire, the guy wires that hold up telephone poles with a wrench.
Yeah.
You tap the wire with a wrench and you get that sound and you slow it down or you do things to it, you manipulate it, but all of a sudden it's a pew, 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 pew. And once you hear it, you can't unhear it.
And I remember the day that I learned that I like ran down our driveway and, you know,
with a wrench.
Started tapping this and it's exact. It's like, it's
the sounding. Yeah.
It's instant and it's perfect. And it's right there.
Yeah. And the beauty of it is your brain, you know, if you don't know, then that's the sound that came out of that blaster. It's stunning. But you know, even
the concept is so fascinating.
We're looking at this now. It was, I mean, the Kronos effect was 20 years old because Star Trek VI was 1991. So 20 years of this thing, but it still feels fresh.
Yeah. It still works. And it would look weird without it, even though, like, to me, the Death Star blowing up the right way will always be without that effect, but it does look really cool in the special edition. I'll never argue that. And now, you know, with so many of these things, we've been taught to assume, we've been taught that that's what this means.
Hey, that's something. Yes, exactly.
Way, so a bunch of energy comes out. You're going really fast. So we'll show you running really slow. Okay. I'm along for the ride. Like you said. And I'm so glad you said the flash because of that's exactly right.
I have to say, as we're saying goodbye to Red Skull, I have to really appreciate his discipline with oral care because those teeth are just perfectly aligned. I mean, he's been flossing every day. He's really impressive. He might be a bad guy, but he really does know how to take care of his teeth.
Well, on that respect, I had a question for you, gents, and that is I looked very carefully as the Red Skull dissolved to see what was under the Red Skull, and I think more skull.
Yeah.
I think it's skull on top of skull.
It's skulls all the way down, yeah.
I was going to point out that exact same thing because it was, you know, you're thinking back to Raiders of the Lost Ark and the face melting and things, but what is there to melt? And yet, you know, he manages. There's some stuff that melts off. And I guess, you know, there was a little bit of skin on him after all.
Yeah. They didn't quite do the tote candle, but it was pretty close. And he's much more colorful end than those, than the other Nazis we've seen go up in smoke.
Right. Yeah. He didn't just poof. And the way his eyes glow.
Yeah.
As, you know, the last sort of view of his eyes before like fire comes out of them and stuff. That is just absolutely.
Yeah,
absolutely.
He deserved that.
He did.
And
this is not a good guy.
The Tesseract does work like alien blood, that it can just melt through anything. I'm impressed that it gets right through the bottom of the flying wing. Well, no
that's
trouble.
That's another note of mine, though. Again, why? It's never melted through anything before. And last minute, Hal was talking about how maybe his impression was the Tesseract had been bound, had been chained, had been harnessed for so long that now it's got a chance to kind of break free. And I subscribe to that interpretation. I think that's right. And now it's got so much energy, nothing could hold it, not even the steel deck of this aircraft.
Right. But yeah, it makes me wonder, why didn't they make the airplane out of, you know, whatever they've been carrying it around in? You know, they should have, thinking we're going to prevent this. But yeah, I think it's energy. It's blasted the Red Skull into the cosmos, and its energy, I just sort of take it as meaning its energy can just no longer be contained.
Yep. It
hits the bottom of the ocean.
All of them seem to have some kind of sentience, I think. All of the stones. I think that's how the Soul Stone became part of Vision. I think that he became sentient because of the stone. So I think it has its own sentience that it's leaking out into the universe. They all have, and it could be involving fate. Because that's what we were talking about, the tree of the world. At the very beginning, the Red Skull is talking about fate and how the tree of the world is the master of it's the source of fate. So maybe the Tesseract might know its own fate, might be beyond time, and just has to get to the next place in the universe where it's needed.
I like that.
I like
the bottom of the ocean, apparently.
But yes, but right,
for now.
Yeah, they could have the credits going, but the Tesseract would return in the Avengers.
Yes, exactly. The Tesseract will return. It's either For Your Eyes Only or the Avengers. I forget which one. It's definitely
coming. It's a nice minute, and it's a very fitting end for our supervillain, the Red Skull, who let's just one more time give it up for Hugo Weaving, who was under this mask. I was going to say the whole time, but sometimes we see Hugo Weaving's real face, but most of the time he's acting in this mask, which is, I think that's a big ask for an actor, especially sort of a leading man, you know, a big name actor.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, check in with the Mandalorian. I mean, this is a tough go, or Anthony Daniels for that matter.
Yeah.
I said big name actor.
Yeah. That's
right. Hey. Oh, Anthony, we love you. Yeah. And it's funny with the Mandalorian is we spend all this time establishing the lore that the helmet can never come off. And then, you know, first chance we get though, you know, we got to see Pedro Pascal and now he's in everything, you know, the Last of Us, he's Reed Richards and Fantastic Four.
And maybe deservedly so. Of course.
Oh, he's a great guy.
The dirty I've secret of the Mandalorian is there's like four different guys who are the Mandalorian, right?
Right.
There's Pascal who does the voice and takes off the helmet when he needs to, but there's two or three stuntmen who are also the Mandalorian.
Right.
And he always, to Pascal's credit, he always gives full credit to them.
And you know, for the past couple of minutes that we've been watching this, don't think that Chris and Hugo were wrestling it out across the deck. I think one beauty of having it wearing a helmet and the other guy wearing a red skull, it's real easy to swap folks out.
Exactly. Yeah, and it's, you know, it's not your, you know, big burly stuntman putting on a blonde wig and playing the damsel in distress from 100 feet away. It's, as you said, it's much more straightforward than that.
Yeah. One last comment that I have about the seeing all the different people. We're back in Hydra headquarters there, and we see Jim Morita and Colonel Phillips and Agent Carter. And I know they're supposed to be wearing uniforms, but I've never seen two people in the same uniform in the Army here. And it continues on with, I mean, I know that she's in the Strategic Science Reserve, but aren't they all in the strategic? Shouldn't they all have the same uniform? She's got on one outfit, Jim's got on another one, and the Colonel, he's in a third.
That's kind of violates the spirit of a uniform when it's not uniform.
Yeah.
Right. And I mean, for Marita, I just took that to mean because we see, not Falstaff from the comics, but the British. Not Dum Dum, who turned out to be not British after one issue of comics, but the British para in the movie, the Howling Commandos. I'm just drawing a blank on his name, and I feel really bad about that. He still wears a British uniform, and you know, I kind of picture like with the Commandos, they're going to sort of dress, you know, aligned with sort of the units they came from. But yeah, Peggy and Phillips are supposed to be in the same organization. You know, and Phillips is just back there wearing looks like kind of more like tactical, like a tactical jumpsuit or more tactical fatigues, or kind of modern.
Yeah. Falsworth. Yeah. That's him.
Falsworth. Thank you.
So but close. Yeah. And like, I, Peggy's wearing some kind of bomber jacket or something, and it's just, I don't know, it doesn't seem like at all. Anyway, hopefully if our costume designer Anna Shepherd says yes, we can ask
Right.
these questions. But
And
she'll just tell me it's just a movie, but it's okay.
but you know there's you we know well enough to know that there was some serious thinking that went into it.
Yeah.
That is true.
So there's, nothing in a film like this, at least under Joe's watch, happens just randomly or by accident, it seems.
I do have one other question on the video. At the very end of this, we're watching the flying wing, and all the engine status seems to be very, very bad.
Right. Either pretty bad or really, really bad,
If you
which we're
scroll
still discussing.
if you scroll through this very slowly, it's a film strip. There's like film
Oh, there's film grain.
artifact. Yeah, which just is the thing.
And
It does. Is it carrying like a half a mile of unprocessed
why
film in
would
it?
they do that? Just subconsciously to inform us old? Is that the impression they're trying to give us?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I would have thought if it's like a if they're using field replication instead of
Oh, you're
an
right. You can see
electronic.
that. It flickers and it's got the film scratches.
And going back to the earlier display, and by the way, the direct translation of German Ziel to English is goal, so that makes sense,
Oh, okay,
destination,
yeah.
your result. But when you look at that, we see New York City, and then there's this super high speed
Whoosh,
panning that happens,
yeah,
and
like
that
a
looks to me like
microfilm.
microfiche. Yeah,
Yeah,
that's
yeah.
exactly what I said. That's what that looks like to me, like we're scrolling over there. So, you could envision some kind of, like, for the map display, I can certainly imagine, that's not something that is being sort of drawn on this screen. I can see that as being,
Yeah.
we have, a microfiche kind of map of at least this hemisphere, and then we are somehow projecting on top of it the other
Yeah.
data. That would make perfect sense to me. And you could make
Sounds right
that
to me.
case for the flying wing with the status stuff, but why would it have grain? Why would the background be refreshing at all? I
Yeah,
don't
does
know.
I mean maybe it has 60 different or whatever the now I've forgotten the name. The when you put an exclamation mark after something, you're figuring out every possible
Factorial?
variation.
Oh, yeah.
Binomial, factorial, yeah. Like whatever, one, two, three,
Factorial,
the factorial of eight. And yeah, it has the
yeah.
factorial of eight number of film strips. So it's like
Right.
when engines one and two and five, six, seven, and eight are out, run this film strip.
Right.
So.
On the other hand, though, I mean, those, if we say the background is like a static microfiche type image,
Yeah.
But then we're using some mechanism to draw the red on top of that. I mean,
Yeah.
there would be a visible, a visible refresh rate, and there could be, I don't know that I would see grain, but I would certainly expect to see some flicker or something like that
Well, that's
happen. Yeah.
consistent with your thoughts about the map technology too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think that's good. I think we
We
go with that.
yeah, there was a back long ago in the early 60s, supermarkets used to sell toys, and the or they do now, but I mean back then it was a rather a novel thing, and the there was sold only in supermarkets. There was something called Jet Fighter, and
Oh,
it was a
yeah.
little control panel, and it had
I had it.
a little wheel. Me
I had
too.
it. I
and
wanted it.
and the thing in the, the they had a little view screen in the middle, and it just had this roll of film that would
Yep.
scroll over, and you'd see farms and you'd see towns, and then you'd see the same it was like Hanna-Barbera. You'd see the same thing
Right.
fly over every once in a while. But that's what I was thinking. This is a lot like Jet
Yep.
Fighter.
Yeah, it is.
Yep.
Well, even during the war, when you were doing sort of quasi simulation type things for practicing for bombing runs and things like that, you would have like a motion picture moving around in quote or motion picture camera moving around quote unquote real time, like over a diorama,
Yeah.
and then that view would be would be fed to the simulator as you're practicing navigation and stuff. So
Well,
there's some
Jim, you would remember
precedent
it better
there.
than me, but that's also how they practiced for the lunar landing in the
That's
Apollo mission,
correct.
is
Yeah,
they had a physical model of the lunar surface that they would just panic, or not pan's the wrong word, but move a camera around as if you were flying over it.
actually, they do it the other way around. They'd move the landscape. The camera was static, and they'd move the
That's right.
landscape around. So it was
That's right.
just kind of, I guess
That's
it
right.
worked. So,
But It sounds like you just discovered like a miraculous new means of propulsion. We want to go to the moon, but instead of moving the lander to the moon, we move the moon to the lander.
A little bit closer. Yeah. No, it could work.
Have you guys really thought about this?
I think I saw that in one of the Despicable Me movies. One of the
as good a place as any.
Oh my gosh. Wow. Well, this has been a fascinating minute. We've only got a few minutes left to go. We're down to the final 11 of our show. Oh, and to the relief of our audience, or maybe increasing sadness. So prepare yourself, because we're coming down to the, you know, our top 10 episodes.
Our final 10 episodes.
Our final 10. Yeah. You don't want to,
let's not set the bar too high. Let's not overset expectations.
If Haley ever calls in, we may have another episode. So we'll see what happens.
We'd certainly do a special episode for her, for Steve, Neil.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah. We'll see. It's the guy that sweeps the floors.
I mean Chris. It's
Tommy Lee hasn't said no either, so we'll never, you know, don't, the microphones will always be open. But you know, keep your fingers crossed. And if Tommy Lee, if you're listening, we're here. You know how to get it reaches.
Yeah, but that's how Tommy Lee Jones spends his time.
Yeah. Oh, here's a podcast about my show here. So, anyway, if you would like to, even if you're not Tommy Lee, if you would like to continue this conversation, we're always available over at Camp Lehigh, the Captain America Minute listeners base on Facebook. And if you do like our show, please don't forget to subscribe, leave a like at the podcast streaming service where you found this episode. Also, please check out our website, capminute.com, for the latest about our podcast topics and guests. And be sure to join us here next time on the Captain America Minute.
I can do this all day.